Welcome to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. Dr. Michael McGee here, your host. Good to be with you again this week. Hope you're doing well with all the difficulties and challenges and adversities that we're all facing together. This week, I'm excited to share with you that we have a new guest named Dr. Rita Louise. Dr. Rita, as she's called, is what's called a medical intuitive, and she has really specialized on the relationship between people who are empathic and those who suffer from narcissism, the wound of narcissism, and so we'll be hearing a lot about that from Dr. Rita. Dr. Rita, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. Looking forward to talking about love.
Yes, wonderful to have you. Yeah, so tell our audience a little bit about yourself and your background.
So, most of the work that I've done has been in alternative thought topics, health and healing, psychic abilities, intuition, energy medicine, but then I kind of branched off for a while and really explored ancient mysteries, ghosts and the paranormal, and have recently released a new book called The Dysfunctional Dance of the Empath and Narcissist, which was brought forward into my awareness because of my own personal experience in apparently getting involved in multiple relationships with multiple narcissists. And, you know, as a researcher and in wanting to work on my own healing, I was doing all this research and decided to go ahead and document what I was finding to help other people in their journey to experience happiness and joy in their lives and not keep repeating this same pattern of finding toxic love relationships, which seems to plague so many people.
Yeah, you know, that I'd love to hear more about that. One thing I'll make a comment about that, just my own personal feeling about this as a psychiatrist, is I really hate the term narcissist, and I'll tell you why. It's such a negative, stigmatizing, kind of hateful label to put on human beings. And I personally sort of feel like, in terms of working with people with narcissism, I talk about people suffering from narcissism rather than being narcissists. And I want to make that point to our audience that we really don't want to ever negatively label any human being, even people who suffer from psychopathy or antisocial disorder or suffering from narcissism. Our reaction to narcissism is sort of a reaction of disdain, or it's a negative reaction because people with narcissism can be so hurtful. But I think it's just wanted to share that thought about that labeling people as narcissists versus thinking about them as suffering from narcissism.
Well, and I'm just going to throw back, you know, on a personal level, I hate the term codependent, you know, and so sometimes you have to go, okay, I don't like that, and I don't like that aspect of myself, and I hate that word personally because I are one. But it gives you the opportunity, if you want, to move through it and move past it and create a better life for yourself.
Yeah, you know, I'm so glad you said that. I don't like the word codependency at all, because what I think it does is it pathologizes normal human functions like attachment. And sure, I think there are issues, but even if you believe in codependency, which I don't really do, it would be better to say that I suffer from a bit of codependency rather than to say I am a codependent. Those labels are just so limiting and dehumanizing. But yeah, so to tell us a little bit more about your book and about what you've discovered in your personal journey with dealing with people who suffer from narcissism.
So for myself, you know, working as an intuitive, you know, you have empathic abilities. You know, you're able to feel other people's feelings. And what I discovered was that people who tend to fall into that people-pleasing, codependency-type personality very often attract individuals that have narcissistic personality traits. You know, so I'm not saying that they necessarily have narcissistic personality disorder, but narcissistic traits into their lives. And so I was looking at it as this give and take dynamic of what am I as an empath bringing to the table, and where is the individual that's a narcissist, where are they coming from, so I can look at this dance that's happening, and then if I choose, how to eradicate myself and exit stage left from that dynamic and not recreate it.
Right, right, right. So, yeah, so how is that, can you give us sort of concrete examples of how it unfolds so that people can recognize and understand it better?
So, I mean, I think one of the things that happens, well, one of the things that I have uncovered, and I don't know that you'll necessarily agree with this, is that individuals who tend to be empathic often achieve that ability to sense what's going on in a space, to feel what other people are feeling, you know, not just in having empathy, but really on a body level where it can even become very confusing of, well, this is how I feel, or is what I'm feeling actually something that I'm picking up from the environment? But many times they developed that skill because they also come from a traumatizing environment. You know, they grow up in a dysfunctional family, and they manifest this as a coping skill. You know, in much the same way that an individual who has narcissistic tendencies, you know, many times came from a family with issues, and that was their coping strategy to navigate the dysfunction in the family. And it just so happens that their dysfunctions are on opposite ends of the scale. And they magically attract to each other because they are, on some levels, filling the wounds that the other person has. They're filling the needs that the other person has, all in a desire to get the love, attention, and affection that they never really received as a child.
That's so well articulated, Dr. Rita. Yes, that is so true. They're both coping strategies, is what you're saying, for trying to survive and get love growing up, and then they bring those coping strategies into adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, what the book really focuses on is to help people recognize these patterns in their lives. Obviously, focusing more on the empathic personality. So that they can bring about changes so that they don't have to keep living, you know, in a silent world and in a world where they can't speak their truth or be their authentic self in their relationships.
Yeah. Right, right, right. So how do you recommend for people that what you're saying basically for people who are empathic is they use empathy is a way to sort of deeply read what's going on with other people, to then sort of meet those other people's needs so that in return they would get a sense of being accepted and valued through almost like an exchange of giving people what they want to get the love that they want in return. And what you're saying then is that for people with empathy that there's a need to sort of move towards more authenticity of expressing and tuning into their own authentic needs and truth, even though that may risk possibly not getting what looks like love and recognition from other people. Is that about right?
That's exactly right. You know, but the sad thing is that many times these empathic individuals, you know, they give all of their energy away. I mean, they're the ultimate people pleasers. You know,
right.
So they give all of their energy away, but they hook up with individuals who aren't really willing to give them anything. Unless it's conditional. Well, you know, I'll like you, and I'll give you attention because really I want attention, and so that's why I'm giving you the attention. And
exactly.
So, you know, they just get to re-experience the same childhood wound. It's like, well, I'm giving, looking for the attention, validation, and love that I never got, and they still don't ever get it. And so they don't ever have the opportunity to heal.
Absolutely. Boy, that is so beautifully and clearly said, Dr. Rita. Thank you. In both cases, in both polarities, the empath and the narcissist, they're both these people with narcissism can be, what they want also is love and power and control and sort of a sense of affirmation of their own value through the admiration of other people. And it's almost like they're addicted to other people's admiration and addicted to other people serving them and caring for them because of their own love deficit inside. And so both are coming at the relationship, the empath and the person suffering from narcissism, from a place of love deficiency, as I see it. And really what they're putting out is not love for love's sake alone, but it's sort of, if you will, emotional goods that are given out in the exchange for somebody feeding their love deficit. People with narcissism can be so charming, right? I know somebody right now who it's my dear wife, Linda, but in her prior relationship, she was with somebody who wined her and dined her and gave her jewelry and just was so charming and loving until she made a commitment to him. And then at that point, it's like she said, he sold me a bill of goods, but he never delivered. And so I think that people with narcissism can be very, very charming and sort of very giving, but with this sort of this ulterior motive of seducing and getting people into an attachment where then these people who are empathic are sort of bound to serving their needs. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
Well, I mean, I think the empathic individual is going to be more compliant and stay in a relationship where they find out they've been sold a bill of goods, trying to make it work. You know, I have a similar story. So my late husband, I was wife number 6 for him.
Oh, dear.
Wow. And many of his relationships were very dysfunctional. He came from a very dysfunctional household. Wonderful, caring, giving man with a bit of an anger issue, but that was, you know, he was very easily triggered. And when he and I got married, about a month later, he looked at me and he goes, well, I'm waiting. And I'm like, well, waiting for what? And he goes, well, I'm waiting for you to change. I mean, what do you mean change? It's like, you know, this is it. You know, I might not do my hair as often, you know, but I'm not really sure what you're talking about. And apparently, in all 5 of his relationships, once he said, I do, or they said, I do, all bets were off. You know, when you hear stories like that, you move in with someone, you end up getting pregnant, you know, for the female listeners, because it's not, you know, male narcissist and female empath. I mean, it could be the other way around. He was a total empath. You know, but they often will find ways of getting you stuck, get you to quit your job, you know, so you become financially dependent on them. And then, yeah, once they have that security in place, the mask comes off and Mr. Sweet, kind and loving you know, might not be there as much.
Right, right. So true. So relationships, getting into relationships can be so tricky because what appears on the surface is so critical to sort of have a capacity to discern maybe a deeper truth in people. So tricky. Can I ask you, Dr. Rita, we'll probably just a couple more minutes in this section, but we'll continue when we hit a break here soon. But I just would love to explore with you your thoughts about how to help people with empathy, empathic people, how to help them to get out of this sort of dysfunctional way of relating to this sort of agenda of being empathic to other people and meeting their needs in order to get their own needs for love met. How do you help deliver people from that?
I think one of the biggest things, you know, and I feel like, okay, so it's not that every empath will find themselves getting into toxic relationships. It's the ones that have really deep inner wounding, you know, the ones that do have people-pleasing or subjugation core beliefs. It is the ones that find themselves being a bit more codependent or find themselves getting enmeshed in relationships. You know, it's those individuals that have to really take an inventory about what's going on. You know, I've talked to a number of people, and, this is usually not their favorite point that I make, is that, you know, as the person getting in the relationship, if you find yourself getting into the same kind of relationship over and over again, you know, I think the first step is to take a step back and go, what am I bringing to the table, or what am I not bringing to the table that's causing me to get involved with these people and then staying? You know, it's one thing to date someone for a while and then go, nah, this isn't working, and move on. It's another thing to be with someone, get to see that person that's underneath the mask, and then still choose to stay.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. You made such a couple of really, really good points here. The first thing, that just because you're empathic, I mean, empathy is a wonderful skill and gift. And in a way, what I hear you saying is that it's not so much being empathic that's the problem. It's the problem of leveraging that capacity out of an inner wound, out of what I call a love deficit, if you will, and leveraging empathy as a way of serving and meeting the needs of another person in order to get something in return, which I think, you know, unconsciously, I think we probably all do that to some varying degree. Nobody loves perfectly, at least I haven't met it. Maybe the Dalai Lama might love perfectly, but we all have that yearning to be loved, and we all have that yearning to belong and to be valued and appreciated. And I think we all can be vulnerable to sort of empathically tuning into what somebody else needs and then to sort of meet or be giving to another person and have sort of an underlying agenda of being loved back. I think that's kind of very, very human for us to have that to some degree. But what you're saying is that it's not being empathic, but it's having such a degree of a love wound or love deficit that really becomes the way that you operate in a way that's ultimately harmful to you in the long run. I don't know. Does that resonate for you?
I mean, that resonates with me. There's a couple things that we could maybe come back and talk about, but no, that's pretty darn close.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, we're going to take a break here, but the other thing that you mentioned that I'd love to return to, Dr. Rita, is you talked about this idea of sort of taking an inventory and with clear seeing exactly what you're doing. And I'd love to return to that idea that sort of the root of healing is in the seeing, that the seeing is freeing to sort of get beyond this trap, to be awareness, how important awareness is. If that would be okay with you, I'd love to return to that, if that's okay. Great. Well, you're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike with our wonderful guest today, Dr. Rita Louise. Dr. Rita, talking about healing and loving relationships between people who are empathic and also people who suffer from narcissism. We'll be right back after this break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike, Dr. Michael McGee here, your host, with our guest, Dr. Rita Louise, talking about toxic relationships for empaths and people with narcissism. Welcome back, Dr. Rita.
Thanks for having me. This has been a great conversation so far, so I'm looking forward to where we're going next.
Great. Me too. It's been a great conversation. I hope our listeners are enjoying it as much as we are. You know, Dr. Rita, you left off with you sort of mentioning this idea of taking an inventory. And I know in the 12-step program of recovery from addiction, and in a way we can almost think about this almost as a kind of a relationship addiction in a way. But in the 12-step program, the fourth step is to take a fearless and searching moral inventory. And I've always been really struck by what an important step that is in the healing process in terms of really, really developing a deep awareness of what we're doing and why we're doing it. And I'm wondering if you have any more thoughts about that as sort of a starting point maybe or as part of a starting point for healing from these dysfunctional relationships.
You know, one of the things that I believe is that, you know, when we get into a romantic relationship, you know, it's the same as getting in, it's the same dynamic. So we employ the same tools we had and used when we were a child. And so when we start looking back in time, I mean, this is what happened to me. It's like I ended a very dysfunctional relationship, but I had like this giant Band-Aid ripped off where I actually saw this pattern for the first time ever.
How did you see it? How did you come to see it? That's really interesting.
So I ended this relationship. It's actually kind of a very interesting story. So the gentleman I was with, I don't know if he had some severe mental issues or if he was just a drunk or both. I could never quite figure that out. Kicked him out. He was living with me. I knew he was never going to come to get his stuff, ever, and I didn't want it here. So I got a friend with a truck, and we put his stuff into his truck, and I drove 2 hours to get his stuff back to him, which, you know, on some levels I'm like, well, that was kind of stupid on my part, but I just needed it to be done. And I decided to not go to where he was going to be living and just had the friend with the truck go. He dropped me off at a restaurant down the street, and I'm sitting in the restaurant, and I get a text message from my ex-husband, so not the husband who passed away when I was number 6, a different husband, married too many times, from his current wife. And she's like, I need to talk to you about Jim, you know, because he's doing this stuff, and I want to kind of check in with you. But I've only ever spoke to this woman at a wedding, okay? So I didn't really know her that well. And I'm like, okay, well, you got my curiosity piqued because the gentleman I was getting rid of had characteristics of that husband. So we get on the phone, and she was like, he's a narcissist, you know, and it was just like, well, I had just started looking up things about narcissism and this whole thing with that concept, and I started really comparing the dynamics of the two relationships. And they kept going back in time, back in time, back in time, back in time to my family of origin, you know, and the neglect and abuse and narcissism of my mom. And, you know, decided to start looking at how our family of origin and the dynamics that we experience in those formative years create this pattern within ourselves that we just keep recreating in all of our relationships.
Yeah. And what did those patterns look like?
So for me, you know, so this was my story. This is my story growing up. Growing up, I always thought that my mother hated me. she would repeatedly tell me that I was the thorn in her side. She was an authoritarian, you know, my way or the highway kind of disciplinarian. You didn't really have any choices. She managed and controlled everything. I have 7 brothers and sisters. I was the family scapegoat, big time. And, you know, I grew up feeling like I didn't matter and I didn't care. And basically, and one of the big things that came forward fairly early on was that when I would do things, when I would have these people-pleasing behaviors, it was because I didn't feel like I had a choice, and tied to that was a lot of guilt. And so, and so not that I've, like, dealt with all of that. I'm still, you know, it's a work in progress. But at least there's awareness, and in a lot of areas it's a lot better. But again, you know, when you deal with trauma, you know, it can be better, but it's not necessarily that you get over all of it. You know, you can, I mean, I guess there's the possibility that you can get over all of it, but I think, you know, the reality is that there's always going to be something that's going to trigger you. Maybe not severely, but on some level, somewhere, somehow, down the road.
Rita, I think what you're saying is just so wise and so authentic, and I just, first of all, I'm so sorry for the traumatic childhood that you suffered, because that is just so damaging to, profoundly, profoundly soul damaging to, you know, to have the experience of your own mother that you are unlovable or that you're bad, so profoundly damaging. And what you're saying is that for you to survive, literally to survive, you developed sort of this empathic people-pleasing, and you had the gift as an intuitive of sort of reading other people. And for survival, like you said, you had to be able to do that and please others just to sort of fit in and survive. You were very much...
And can I just throw something in?
Sure.
There are so many people that come from a history like this. And you know, there are people that I've talked to, and their history make mine look like a walk in the park, you know? I mean, we don't all come, because there are families that are very healthy and supportive, and trauma is minimal, but I think that there are more often than not families that are fraught with dysfunction. I just want to get this in before we go to break, because I know that's coming. You know, but by owning your story, it gives you the opportunity to let go of the shame. And that reduces so much energy on your soul that it just that can be liberating.
Owning your story gives you the opportunity to let go of your shame. That is so well said. It's really true. It's like accepting, this is telling your story. This is the truth of what happened to me. And this is the truth, seeing clearly the truth and speaking the truth that allows you to be released from that, the shame that can come up from keeping all of this a secret in a way, from yourself and keeping it a secret from everybody else at the same time. Yeah, very, very well said. Well, good. Well, you're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike and our guest, Dr. Rita Louise, and we'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike and Dr. Michael McGee here, your host, and we have with us as our guest Dr. Rita Louise, and we're talking about sort of healing the love wound for people who have used their empathy as a way of trying to manage their love wound and to sort of recover from that way of relating to other people. Welcome back, Dr. Rita.
Hi, Dr. Mike.
Yeah.
And where are we going now? On this journey to self-healing.
I know. Well, let's talk about that. I mean, I think what we've come to very clearly that you, and I so much appreciate your wisdom, you said a few things that I just want to emphasize for our listeners. One thing that you said was that to sort of claim, to take an inventory and sort of name it and claim it. What is the truth of who I am, what my experience is, and my way of behaving and relating? I want to do an inventory. And that's so, so important, I think. And then you also talked about sort of one issue I think that's very important is that I think that as far as when you have a love wound like this, when you have trauma, and the fact is about 60% roughly, as far as I read the literature, about 60% of people have some sort of really, really significant trauma. I mean, we're all wounded in large and small ways, and just being a human being in our society can be wounding. But a lot of people, very common to have very, very significant wounding, which is the whole purpose of our show, is to really help people to sort of heal from that. So those are a couple things. And I think that a love wound or this trauma, you're right, it can be significantly healed. And maybe someday it pretty much goes away completely, but there's always that vulnerability for that to be re-triggered. But I think with mindful, loving presence, with awareness and clarity and a loving heart, that woundedness can be managed. And really the essence of the healing is to be able to really learn to manage that our woundedness. So I'd love to hear more about, you know, you've talked about sort of the wound of a lack of self-love that you experienced because of the mother that you had in part. Tell us a little bit more about what you're learning about how to develop self-love. What's that recovery look like for you?
I mean, I think of everything that I've done so far, this has been the most challenging part because I don't feel like it was ever modeled for me. You know, what was modeled for me was how to take care of everybody else and never to take care of myself. And so, you know, when I ask myself, well, what do I want? You know, this is where it's been. You know, it's like you ask yourself, well, what do I want? You know, what do I want to do? What do I want to get? I mean, for me, it's like crickets. You know, it's just this dead air cricket, something. It's definitely something. And so for many people, especially if that wounding goes to a really early age, they might not have developed the skills, you know, it might never have been modeled for them so that they have the, you know, I'm going to say tools to use in order to do that. So as an example, you know, sometimes in a slightly different way, you know, there are people that they had a skill, but then the skill was stepped on, and so now they don't use it anymore. But at some point in time, they were able to utilize that skill. You know, what I'm suggesting is in many individuals that have self-love issues is that they never utilize that skill because there was never any room or opportunity for them to flex that muscle. And so it's kind of like you have to learn, you know, and depending on how old you are, it might be more challenging than others to understand what self-love is or what right looks like. You know, sometimes it's even a matter of, okay, so this happened, and you say, okay, I didn't like this, and I'm going to love myself enough to say, no, I don't want to do this, or no, I don't want to participate in this. And sometimes it has to be a very conscious choice where for other people it's just something that's natural because they have that skill and they have that ability because they practiced it over the years throughout their lives.
You know, what you're talking about in a way is almost like language, like we're able to talk to each other. And it's love, self-love is a capacity, you're saying. And you're saying that if that was not modeled for you or taught to you when you're young, it's almost like there's a disability, that self-love as a learned capacity was not learned early on because it was not taught early on. Is that what you're saying?
Right. I mean, it's like someone's ability to make a decision. You know, there are some people that are great at making decisions, but over time it's like they make a decision, but they make a bad decision. You know, they make a bad decision, they make a bad decision, so they choose internally to stop making decisions and to give it to someone else to make the decision, and then they just follow. Some people just don't know how to do it, and there's just not anything in their psyche that prepares them to do that. And it's not that it's broken. It's just that they've never learned how to do it. You know, they never learned how to tie their decision-making shoes. So they don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
Same thing with self-love.
So self-love is a capacity that people never learn. But so how do people, in your experience, Dr. Rita, how is it that you are learning or practicing self-love?
You know, it's taking situations day by day, one by one. You know, if something arises, you know, I sit there and talk about, you know, the me factor. You know, people that tend to be people-pleasing don't have the me factor or the I factor. You know, well, how does this make me feel? You know, and when we make that comment, many of the times we'll tap ourselves on the chest. You know, well, how does that make me feel? And so I challenge people to use that, or, you know, I challenge myself, well, how does that make me feel? Or what do I want to do? And really bring things into the me and I part. But then there's always that little caveat, you know, if you were brought up in that mentality, that is where guilt will jump in every time they try to sabotage you. And so it causes you to have to sit there and go, okay, so is this me? You know, is this just something I want? I'm feeling guilty about it.
Right. So in some ways, the distinction is so, if you're loving, self-love, you're saying that you almost feel, you've been programmed to feel guilty about having self-concern and about me. And yet actually self-love is, in a sense, involves a concern for one's own health and well-being and vitality, and there's nothing wrong with that. So you're having to sort of see that guilt arise and then go, no, misprogramming. It's okay to love myself.
Exactly.
Oh, Dr. Rita, it's so wonderful to talk to you and have you on the show, and I hope that people who are interested will learn more about you. I know that they can. You have a website called soulhealer.com, and on that site you talk about your work as a medical intuitive, and there's a section here on your book, The Dysfunctional Dance of the Empath and the Narcissist. And I know people can schedule sessions with you to do intuitive work. So you really are leveraging your gifts to love and serve and help others who have also perhaps been wounded in similar ways. I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Mike. Great conversation.
Yeah, great conversation. You've really contributed so much to our audience. Thank you. And we'll stay in touch, okay?
Okay, that sounds perfect.
Great. You're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Michael McGee, with our guest today, Dr. Rita Louise. And stay tuned. I'm going to be back to have some concluding thoughts for you. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. Dr. Michael McGee here. By the way, you can learn more about me and my work at howtolove.com. Really appreciated having Dr. Rita Louise on the show. I really appreciated her honesty and her authenticity and the clarity of the wisdom. And really appreciate what she's saying about sort of this healing from the trauma of being unloved, as she was and as so many people are growing up. This healing is an ongoing process for many of us. I'd like to come back to the issue of self-love, because it is really, really, really true. It's a cliche, but but it really is developing self-love that is at the core of leading a loving life. Not that loving others and loving self are sort of an either-or, they're sort of a both-and, but self-love is so necessary as part of that process. And I'd like to share just some general strategies that we can continue to elaborate as we go forward with this show. You know, obviously there's really several things that Dr. Rita mentioned, and some other thoughts that I have to add to that. But seeing the wound is really so important. It's important to see the wound and to see the way that we're managing the wound and to see that really our coping strategies, whether it be pleasing others or manipulating and charming other people, whichever polarity you're on to get other people to meet our needs, that if you see that fundamental agenda that I'm doing A to get B, I'm engaging in A set of behaviors in order to get love from other people. That's the basic formula. And to see that clearly and to see that it's almost like an addiction in a way, that it just doesn't work, whether you suffer from narcissism or from dependency issues or whatever, that way just doesn't heal the love wound itself, that there have to be other ways to heal it. So let's talk a little bit about how to cultivate self-love. One thing that there are many different issues to this, but I think one thing that's important to practice is sort of a form of spiritual reparenting, is the way I think of it, spiritual reparenting. And it's really to take a sort of a combining of a practice of mindfulness or awareness of whatever's arising in consciousness, thoughts, feelings, memories, urges, whatever's arising, beliefs, behavior patterns, whatever we're doing, just to see all of that and to look and to look and to attend, to attend, to attend, to attend, to look, to look, to look, to look, and to just sort of develop a clarity. But that clarity is sort of half of the equation. It really has to be combined with what I call appreciation, but other people have referred to. There's components of appreciation that include sort of a compassionate awareness, sort of a very kind, sort of accepting, compassionate attitude towards whatever is arising in consciousness, whatever we happen to be seeing, including our own pain. Including our own vulnerability, including all the unskillful things that we might do, engaging in sort of oftentimes what I call sort of good now, bad later behaviors, seeing all that with kindness and with compassion. So if we see ourselves, for example, maybe striving to please somebody or impress them, and there's sort of an inauthenticity to it, just speaking about sort of people with more dependent vulnerabilities, maybe who are leveraging empathy the way that Dr. Rita talks about in sort of a bartering to try and get love, to sort of see that and see that you're doing that and to see the underlying sort of feeling of self-hatred or unworthiness that might be underneath that, and to hold that all in the crucible of loving awareness. I think a loving awareness is really a practice that is really very, very foundational to healing a self-love wound. If we didn't get that, if we didn't learn that growing up as a child, then it's really important that we parent ourselves and that we provide that kind of love to ourselves. So how do we do that? There's many different techniques. I think, you know, Kristen Neff has talked a lot about self-compassion. And I think the idea is that when you see pain coming up with, and a lot of this can be negative judgments, you know, I suck, I'm a loser, it's hopeless for me, I can't believe I did that, no, you know, I'm not worthy of love. I'm not as good looking as other people. I'm ugly. I'm stupid. I'm not this. I'm not that. I'm not this. I'm too greedy. I'm too selfish. I'm whatever. All those negative, negative, hateful judgments that arise in consciousness. To see all that and to sort of practice consciously, intentionally, reading that with an attitude of self-compassion, with an attitude of like, oh, I'm so sorry you're feeling that way. Oh, this is pain. I'm so sorry this pain is arising. Oh, these judgments are so painful. I'm so sorry this is happening. It's almost like stepping back mindfully as an observer of what's happening in consciousness, in your mind, and almost like seeing this negative sort of hateful programming of the brain, this hateful programming of the brain, and seeing it all, and taking on the attitude of a loving, compassionate observer of what's happening in your mind. And that's where this sort of clarity or awareness is combined with an attitude, what I call appreciation, an attitude of almost sort of compassionate, unconditional compassion towards our experience. And there's a sense of really non-judgment in this. Even if we've done something very unskillful or hurtful, and we find ourselves beating ourselves up for hurt somebody else or hurting ourselves, it's really seeing that and seeing the judgment and stepping back from it and really practicing intentionally an attitude of compassion towards ourselves. Very, very difficult. This is a skill, a mental skill that really needs to be developed with repetition over and over, 100 times, 1,000 times, 10,000 times, really over a lifetime. But with practice, with repetition, we do develop this capacity for loving awareness towards our experience. It's almost as if we're not taking our brains personally and really not identifying with what's happening in our brains, but instead adopting sort of a loving attitude towards whatever's happening in our brains. There's a couple of practices that encourage you to do. One is a loving kindness practice. And that's a practice of sort of repetitively in stillness with an anchor, with a meditative anchor like the breath, saying to yourself, may I be happy, may I be at peace, may I be free of suffering, may I be happy, may I be at peace, may I be free of suffering, and visualizing yourself almost as a young child, if you will, and just sort of wishing yourself love and happiness. It will be automatic at first. It won't feel genuine. But if you do that with enough repetition over a long period of time, you can gradually then cultivate that attitude of kind lovingness that maybe you never had as a child growing up. So a lot to talk about here. Hopefully you stay with us in our future shows as we continue to talk about developing this capacity to love. We're going to end. Our time is up. This is Dr. Michael McGee, your host, and I wish you a good week of love and healing, and hope to have you back next week. Take care.